From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Chris Loffrey, and you're listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state of South Dakota. Listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or ask your smart speaker to play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to our segments podcast. Here's your weekly roundup in news coverage. The South Dakota State Senate is passing a ban on banning plastic bags and straws. Republican State Senator John Wick is prime sponsor of the bill. He says it's similar to the state requiring that certain garbage bags can't be banned for sanitary reasons. Wick says the ban on banning plastic bags extends to towns and reservations that fall within South Dakota boundaries.
I don't see how it would impact them any more than anybody else. I mean, all our towns, I believe, we're all part of one big rectangular small town, and we all should be treated equally.
While no ordinance is in place in any communities in South Dakota, proponents of the bill say Brookings is looking into banning plastic bags. The bill passed 22-12 in favor. It now heads to the House. Efforts to continue rolling back gun restrictions in South Dakota stumbled out of the gate this week in the legislature, but it's just the first of several gun debates on tap this winter in Pierre. SDPB's Seth Tupper reports.
Last year, lawmakers threw out the requirement to have a permit for a concealed weapon. They also repealed a restriction on guns in the state capitol. The first gun bill up for debate this year is Senate Bill 51. As originally drafted, it would have allowed county employees to carry guns and other weapons in county courthouses. Paul Nabholz is a Fall River County Commissioner. He testified in favor of the bill. He says county employees need a way to defend themselves.
They currently cannot protect themselves in a building that announces they are in a gun-free zone.
Several groups testified against the bill, including the South Dakota Sheriff's Association. Dick Teason is a lobbyist for the association. He says the bill would make courthouses more dangerous.
We question the wisdom of legislation that would invite weapons into the courtroom.
Lawmakers added two amendments to the bill during a committee hearing. The amendments caused so much confusion that the committee's vice chairman, Senator Arthur Rush, a Republican from Vermilion, delayed further action until the bill could be redrafted with the amendments included.
And we'll try and get a hard copy so that we can all look at it before our next meeting and know what we did.
There are several more pro-gun bills filed so far this year. One exempts firearms from sales taxes. Another one repeals restrictions on guns while driving motorcycles, off-road vehicles, and snowmobiles. Another one extends the authorization period for certain people to carry guns in the Capitol. A non-binding resolution invites responsible gun owners from Virginia to move to South Dakota. One other bill stiffens gun restrictions. That bill, from Senator Rush, who's a former judge, is a kind of red flag law. It authorizes the creation of risk protection orders to allow the seizure of guns from people who are deemed a risk of injury or death to themselves or others. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Seth Tupper in Rapid City.
House Bill 1057 seeks to criminalize gender-affirming clinical care in South Dakota. As the bill makes its way through the South Dakota legislature, Republican leader Lee Qualm told the New York Times that he is hearing from voters who have different opinions about the bill. What are some of these procedures the legislature seeks to block? What does the data tell us about variations in gender identity and gender expression? On Tuesday, we invited Ann Dillenschneider to join Lori Walsh to bring us her perspective. She's been working with transgender youth and adults since 1992. She is one of 87 providers in the world who has earned the World Professional Association for Transgender Health Specialty Credential in transgender healthcare.
Ann, welcome back. Thanks for being here with us today.
Thanks, Lori. Thanks for having me.
There is so much to talk about today with this, but I want to start with one of the basic sort of fundamental questions that people are asking about this legislation and about gender expression in general, is that, is this a defect? Is this something that is wrong or unhealthy? What are the variations of gender expression? Is this a pathology?
It's actually not a pathology. In 2018, the World Health Organization, which is made up of 194 countries, determined that it's actually not a mental health condition, it's a medical condition. And that was ratified on May 25th of 2019. And in the new ICD-11, which is the coding that all medical professionals and hospitals use, that will be effective of January 1st of 2022, it will be coded as a medical condition. And this is based on research we've had over the last 40, 50 years that shows us that gender is related to at least 12 DNA markers. It's also related to brain structures and also hormone receptivity in utero. So it's fairly complicated, but it is a medical condition. And the mental health conditions we see associated with that have to do with discrimination and stigma. So it's a big change, but it's one that we, who have been working in the field for a long time, knew was coming.
Yeah. How fast is the research moving forward? Would you say, you know, not fast enough? Or do you think that, you know, people are sort of waking up to the idea that this is something that we need to research and understand more completely, particularly before we pass legislation?
Well, there's been research for a good 50 years. And so it's getting better all the time. We're doing more longitudinal studies. Those are really important.
Explain what that means.
That means a longitudinal study means something we're doing over a long period of time, like over 10, 20 years. We follow people and see how things are going. The studies are just so important in terms of determining best evidence-based practice of care, and that's where the World Professional Association for Transgender Health comes into play. That is impacted, of course, with the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Psychological Association, American Medical Association, the American Counseling Association. All of those are players in determining good evidence-based practice.
Let's talk about gender care in general, because when the House legislation was first presented, as it's written, there's a long list of procedures. Right. Some of them are recognizable, like mastectomy. Most people know what that means because of cancer care for adult women. Other procedures, you would have to get a dictionary to look up and see what that means. There's no one-size-fits-all, and that's a very important point to bring out. But in general, for families who are dealing with gender expression, gender identity, transgender youth, what are some of those overall parameters of care? Where do you begin with the questions that you're asking and the kind of care that you might need to receive?
So, yeah, let's go to the beginning. So if a child, you know, presents as gender diverse, basically, at this point, what we're doing is a gender affirmative model, which basically is we follow the lead of the child because we want to make sure the child has secure attachment with parents. We want to make sure that the child is resilient. And so really not a lot is done for children before puberty except to be supportive. Those of us who are trained in doing differential diagnosis can do that. We do know that there's a high correlation between, for instance, autism spectrum, especially high-functioning autism, which used to be known as Asperger's, and being transgender or gender diverse. So that's something that since 2016, best practice is we screen for both. And I have had a child who turned out to simply have high-functioning autism and was not trans. And so very, very careful differential diagnosis work is done, whether it's youth, children, youth, or adults. There are procedures that we do. And so we basically support families, do a lot of education, because remember, a family is transitioning and living into this difference as a whole support team. So I'm always working with parents. I don't do any diagnostic work without the parents. The parents are part of the support team.
What kind of questions would you ask, you know, mom or dad? So, I mean, I remember having friends whose son, his favorite color was pink.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very simple thing, but already they were saying, does this mean anything? Does it mean anything that his color is pink and that he likes princesses? And there was this sort of, you know, no, it doesn't mean he likes pink. Give him something pink. Yeah. And it really, I mean, he liked pink for a while, and then he liked other colors too. And so when you, but it goes goes beyond that, where a kid might come home and say, you know, more to a family. What are some of the questions you ask his or her, their parents, their guardians?
Well, there are questions about how is this child comfortable? What does this child play with? How does this child talk about themselves? Who do they relate to? So there are children who will insist that I'm a boy. And their body, their sex, which is different from gender, gender's inside, sex is outside. Their sex may be female, but they may insist they're a boy. Just roll with that. But we do ask questions. We do a lot of observation. Sometimes it's just that they like boys' clothes more and they're more comfortable, or they like pink, or they like blue, or they like whatever. It's a lot of watching. So we have questions within the diagnostic manual. I think there are 8 that we watch for. And when we move to the ICD-11, there's another set of questions. Under the DSM-5, the diagnostic manual in the U.S. right now, it's a 6-month period that we watch, but under the ICD-11, it will be 2 years. So it's tighter, and we simply watch and are supportive. When puberty happens, things start to change a little bit. But the first thing that needs to be clear about this bill is there's nothing other than mental health support, family support, before what's called Tanner Stage 2, which is a particular part of puberty. So there really doesn't need to be a concern about that, any kind of medical intervention, because it's not happening.
Right. So part of the genesis of this bill comes from Fred Deutsch, mm-hmm. who, you know, did some internet searching and had some concerns, right. and wants to protect, in his words, vulnerable children. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he told the New York Times in their recent report, and we've spoken with him as well, mm-hmm. and consistently he says, let's not rush things. There might be regret. It's time to hit pause. Slow things down. Would you address that a little bit? This notion of, you know, this can move quickly and we need to legislatively hit the pause button.
Okay, so nothing moves quickly at all, ever. So like I say, you know, it will be up to 2 years just for children, and that's not even medical treatment. When we get to regret factors, that's about 1%. There are some earlier flawed studies that were inaccurate and have been proved to be flawed that a lot of people will try to go back to. But it's really important to read the research, because when we misstate what research is saying, we can skew things. And so, for instance, at one point this year, there was a big thing about how over 6,000 men died on Lupron as adults, so we shouldn't give it to children to pause puberty. Well, if you read the study, it said 6,370 elderly men with prostate cancer died of prostate cancer, and they had been prescribed Lupron for palliative care. Mm-hmm. Well, that's different. It's right. completely different. So research, if somebody's citing, asked to see the research someone is citing and actually read it and read the follow-up papers to see if that research is actually holding true or not. But it's a long process. So with children, you know, typically I'm working with the family, I may be working with a pediatrician. Once we get to puberty, then a whole number of things come into play, but that means I'm working with the family practitioner or pediatrician, I'm working with an endocrinologist, and I'm working with the family. So we're constantly building a team and everybody's on the same page. It takes a great deal of time. It takes hours and hours to do a good diagnosis. And the other thing that should be said in that diagnostic part again is that sometimes, yes, people were misdiagnosed, especially before 20, 30 years ago, before we understood the connections between autism spectrum and transgender diagnoses. So somebody may well have been misdiagnosed, so it's not that it's regret they were misdiagnosed, you know. So, but once then, during the time of puberty, until somebody's 16, really the only intervention could be, and isn't always, but can be doing what's called puberty suppression. And so what we do is we put puberty on pause so that breasts don't develop, periods stop, body hair doesn't develop further. And what that does is it lowers the distress that children are often feeling. It's really hard to do good assessment. It's hard to help children move forward developmentally as teens if they're in distress, if they mm-hmm. can't even look at their body in the mirror or take a shower, or if they're self-harming. And so I've watched kids go from being, you know, in the inpatient unit repeatedly every month with their period to being okay and fine. It's about saving lives, because the suicide attempt rate can be as high as 60%.
Right, and let's talk about
that's
this
huge.
This report, 60%. Yeah,
yeah.
That's not, we don't want to brush past that, but
no.
I do want to talk about this report from the American Association of Pediatrics that said specifically the suicide rate can drop a great deal. I don't have the exact number in front of me. If you do, please.
4%.
Drop down to 4%. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If those puberty blocking gender care is provided, help us understand this study, please.
So it's with gender. It's with family support is a big factor, but also the puberty blocking or whatever the child needs. Not every child needs puberty blocking, right? But once we get supportive care in, and the statistics you can find many of them, but it'll go from 31% to 60% of suicide attempts. We're not talking suicidal thoughts. We're talking suicide attempts. So this is about saving lives.
Right.
And it's a conversation. You know, I'm having a conversation with the family for many hours before I send a referral to the endocrinologist. The endocrinologist, in turn, is having several hours of conversation with the family as well, constant monitoring.
Right.
Nothing happens without all this conversation. We're all in contact. The saddest thing for me is people who say that they're supportive of kids and they want to protect children, then why isn't transgender mental health covered under South Dakota's Medicaid?
Right. I want to go and I would read directly from the Association of American Pediatrics statement. And they said, transgender teens who were able to receive treatments to suppress puberty were less likely to ever consider suicide. Mm-hmm. Researchers found high levels of anxiety and depression are common among transgender youth. Mm-hmm. Studies have found as many as 40% of transgender adults have ever attempted suicide. So the numbers are pretty stark there. And,
right.
and this is a different kind of hitting pause. Fred Deutsch is saying, hit pause, don't move forward too quickly. And what we're seeing in the research is if you hit pause on puberty and development, that can give people that treatment, which House Bill 1057 seeks to criminalize, can really help save lives, specifically regarding suicide and suicide ideation. Do I understand that correctly? Am I getting
right.
those facts right?
Yeah, it's right. And it's a Canadian study that has the 60%. There's another one that's 31. And those are both on adolescents. The one you cite's about adults, but it's over their lifetime. So yes, the bill's way of putting things on pause, which doesn't stop puberty, means that literally people are in the inpatient unit constantly because they want to mutilate their bodies. They're so miserable. They're so distressed because their bodies keep developing in the way that doesn't match who they see who they are. And if you want to help us pause puberty, support our medical providers. And they are not functioning in a vacuum either. Remember, they're going under the guidelines of the Endocrinology Society and the American Medical Association. So we have so many sets of guidelines. Even the World Professional Association of Transgender Health, WPATH, those guidelines are 120 pages that
right.
we're following. So we don't get to things like, you know, when they talk about mastectomies or HRT or what they call lower surgeries, none of that is happening in the way this bill states, and that's a problem. Lower surgery doesn't happen until someone's an adult. We don't do it in South Dakota because we don't have the capabilities here. Mastectomy, that depends on a medical team, and that, again, is usually when someone's 18. We don't even begin to think about estrogen or testosterone until the earliest 16.
Right.
So the biggest thing the bill's impacting is the blocking of puberty, and that's absolutely critical for keeping these kids alive.
I want to quote also from or read directly from those standards of care because I want to get at this idea of how the conversation like the one we're having now can be incredibly healthy mm-hmm. as people have a great number of questions. And sometimes an internet search is not the best way to come up with, the evidence-based facts, right?
Right.
But it also, these conversations, and I'm always, critically aware of this, can have another impact as well on people who are being talked about, as you and I are talking about transgender people, and that's not our lived experience. So it says in these standards of care, health is also dependent on good clinical care, but it is also on social and political equality and full rights of citizenship. Speak a little bit, Anne, if you will, about the impact on parents and children of the debate when people say things about, you know, gender care is child abuse and, you know, transgender people are sick. What can this add to the overall healing and health, overall health process of families and individuals?
Wow. I mean, I do have, you know, a child that heard an elected official talk disparagingly about transgender people. It's a younger child, like 9 years old, who tried to commit suicide right after hearing that because they were so distraught. I mean, the things that are being said publicly really, really do impact people a great deal. And, you know, we work with parents. Parents know their kids, you know, and it's helping us understand each child. And so one way to sometimes help people understand what's going on is that, and I learned this from some nurses back in 1994, bless their hearts, and they were the ones who explained to me that sex and gender are often chosen at birth quite a bit, and that there's up to 5 million people in the United States who, when they were born, we could not tell if they were a girl or a boy. That's a lot of people, and we don't talk about that, and that's called being intersex. And it's quite possible that if we can't tell what gender someone is on the outside when they're born, that we might not know on the inside either for quite a while. And so with parents, when they're noticing something different, you know, my job is to support them, to explore with them, to get education. There are other parents who've been through this, but also to work with schools because, and places of worship, workplaces, is that nobody should be discriminated against, that we all have a right to feel safe and to explore who we are. And when the conversation gets into the level it is right now, and some of the things that have been said, it's absolutely terrifying to both families and to children and adolescents.
House Bill 1057 continues to lead headlines across the state, but that's not the only news coming out of Pierre. Legislation creating a so-called modified red flag law has been filed in the state Senate, and the Board of Regents director is pushing a bill creating needs-based scholarships. The Dakota Political Junkies touched on these topics and more this Wednesday. In the moment, host Lori Walsh welcomed University of South Dakota Associate Professor of Political Science Michael Card and Madison Daily Leader publisher John Hunter.
Let's start with red flag laws and this bill that, you know, there's several, Seth Tupper, SDPB Seth Tupper, also just filed a piece on several pro-gun bills filed this year so far. Debate on Senate Bill 51, which is about county employees carrying guns to other weapons into county courthouses. So this is a big picture about gun legislation, but this specific bill is one that is a restriction instead of an expansion of gun rights, and it deals with red flag laws, which is a challenge in South Dakota for sure. John Hunter, what do you sort of see in this red flag law that Arthur Rush is saying, you know, it's modified. Now look at the content of it before you react to what you, you know, might initially think.
Well, you're right, Lori. It is a dichotomy where you have, you know, generally in South Dakota, pro-gun, where we're now allowing guns to a limited degree in the state capitol building. You know, legislators can have guns at their desks, and so and this one then is the other way around. And the red flag idea is that if a person has not yet committed a crime but is determined that they would be at risk to either others or themselves, that officers would have the ability to take those weapons away. And Art Rush is trying to be reasonable about this. He calls it modified. He thinks he's trying to, you know, I mean, he's getting some things from other states and think watering down things a little bit. I think it's a really, in my opinion, a good faith effort to try to find something in the middle. As you know, gun laws of all sorts raise emotions and opinions, and it's very strong. It's hard to get all sorts of things passed. So I do admire the effort in trying to get something reasonable. We don't know if it'll pass, but Art is trying.
Right, and what he's saying is the modified part of this is that he's included a court process to make sure that red flag follows due process that maybe other states haven't addressed. Mike Card, what are your thoughts on sort of this desire to find a compromise that protects people but also protects rights?
Well, it even in our language, to call them red flag laws draws attention to it. In a sense, it's really risk-based gun removal. It does require a court to find clear and convincing evidence that the person and their weapons present a clear danger to themselves and others, and that person, the judge has to find that that person shouldn't be in possession of guns. We don't know if it'll pass. We do know that the National Rifle Association's Institute for Legislative Action release on, I believe it's last year, about this time, said that they might favor emergency risk protection orders under certain conditions. I don't know if these conditions would meet their approval now, and given that it's an election year, whether their standard has increased as Senator Rush is trying to provide more protections for individuals and their liberties, as well as protections for the society as a whole.
And this is one of the interesting things, John Hunter. I know you've been on the South Dakota Focus program before at the year-end wrap-up. You and I were on a panel together. And this last year, when I was on that panel, I can't remember. I think it was KSFY's Brian Allen, who talked about mass shootings, and said virtually nothing has been done. And I was wondering, is that really true in South Dakota? Because the people who people are talking about it. We did the mental health task force is over the summer. The legislature was interested in that. You have this legislation. You have what many people would say, is addressing this idea of a gun-free zone and whether that's a way to prevent mass shootings or to encourage them. I think we are having the conversation in South Dakota, just maybe not in a way that is a sweeping ban on anything. What are your thoughts on that, John? Do you think we're doing nothing, or do you think we're actually kind of doing a fair amount?
Well, Lori, I think you articulated it correctly, and that is there is action and there is discussion on these things. Remember that gun violence in America is a huge problem. You look at all sorts of other, compare ourselves to other countries, do we have more of this problem than others? The trick is that people have just kind of opposite 180-degree different solutions for that. One is more guns. If you get more guns, then the bad guys aren't the only ones with the guns, and then other ones who are saying fewer guns. And
right.
We have strong opinions on both sides, and so. But I think if there is something to feel good about, that is, I think virtually everyone wants to achieve the same goal. We're not trying to get two different goals here. The goal is to reduce mass shootings and gun violence. The solutions we don't have yet, but at least people want address that, recognize the problem, want to do something about it, and now we're trying to figure out what it is. But yeah, I think the discussion is on, and I know that's a common theme in your in the moment is have this discussion, and if you can start to talk about it, solutions may appear.
Right. I remember recently thinking, when was the last time we had a gun safety conversation? And I think I saw out in Rapid City one or two billboards that talked about gun safety. When was the last time we talked about that? So there's so much to have, unfolding in the conversation. It's ongoing, and Seth Tupper's story is also online.
Lori, on that exact same thing there, I just got to bring up a story for Madison. They do have, there's a fellow staffer here at the Daily Leader whose two young sons participate each winter in these shooting sports activities. And they're modestly young. I'm saying, let's maybe 8 and 11 or something like that. And they learn all that kind of how to handle, how to store, how to do all those kind of things with various firearms, and it's designed to be kind of the beginning of a hunting thing, but they also work with pistols and they work with law enforcement and so forth. It's a great deal. Those young men know more about gun safety than most adults do. I'd love to see that program, and although a lot of people aren't going to be interested, I'm not a gun user, or so it wouldn't interest me. But I think a lot of people could benefit from that.
And sometimes it's just overcoming the fear, and the panic of thinking, that this gun is one thing. You can build up this sort of boogeyman in your mind if you never have any contact with a firearm. And Jonathan Ellis and I talked about that in the show once, just both being former military people. You spent a lot of time with weapons, and you know what they are and what they aren't. And that makes a huge difference just to talk about it. Well, let's
right.
hope.
And storage and, and safeties and ammunition. I mean, there's a lot of things to learn.
Right. Let's talk about House Bill 1057, because this is something we did a program on yesterday about gender-affirming health care, what it is and what it isn't. And it's another one of those topics that really, gets people nervous or angry or, impassioned in one way or the other. Mike Card, what are you sort of seeing in this conversation that's new? Any insight? Is this just the same recycled argument?
Well, it seems to be on a slightly different topic as opposed to prior years where we've had LGBTQ issues. This one appears to be more focused on transgender individuals and especially youth. And on the one hand, you might argue that this is a set of out-of-state interests that have influenced a South Dakota legislator to see a need or prevent a problem from occurring in South Dakota. And your speaker on your program yesterday noted that they seem to be talking past each other, that what the program of medical interventions that's described in the bill or seemingly outlined in the bill isn't how the process actually works to deal with individuals who have some degree of gender dysphoria.
Right. I had to get a dictionary out when I read the text of that bill to look up what those procedures even were. John Hunter, there's another bill Phil Jensen introduced, Senate Bill 88, which says that school counselors and social workers and psychologists have to tell a parent if a student comes to them and talks about any kind of, gender identification issues or indications of self-harm. Well, there are already mandatory reporters for self-harm. So basically, it seems like it's legislation to say, as a parent, we have a right to know if our child comes to a school counselor and says, I'm having some issues with that. Again, does this seem like a part of a pattern to you, John Hunter? What's going on?
Well, the first people I think about in that are the counselors themselves, and they are being put in a challenging situation. As we know, being a school counselor can be stressful enough as it is, because they're often dealing with challenges that children bring to school from home or have conflicts at school. They also involve, could be adult authorities at school. There's a lot of different things, and I admire so many school counselors for the work that they do. But we have seen circumstances where the counselor didn't notify the right thing at the right time or something like that, and they have gotten in trouble and lost their jobs and so forth. As I think about this this particular bill, good intentions. You hope it doesn't put further burdens on counselors or cause people not to enter that field, because we need them and we want good ones. So, I don't know how it's going to go. Intentions are good. You never really want to punish or make that job so challenging and legally hard that you discourage people from entering the field.
Right. When you talk about intentions, I know the ACLU is, of course, spoken out about against Senate Bill 88, and one of their points is always, a child who has issues with gender identity is already isolated socially in this state, politically, and now if they know that they can't talk to even a trusted adult at school, if they're not getting any kind of support at home, it further isolates, and that suicide rate is, 40%, 60%, depending on what study you're looking at. Mike Card, talk a little bit, if you will, about isolation and parents' right to understand what's happening with their kids and counselors' rights to, to do their job, and how we balance all these legislatively.
Well, it is a tough tough issue to deal with because you've got the counselors, the social workers, the school psychologists who are working in the under the public interest, and so they are mandatory reporters for suicide ideation as well as a few other issues. You've got the parents and you have the child, and then we have the rest of society that has an interest in these children growing up to be productive adults in our society. And it seems that while I certainly agree with what John said, that this is an idea that has good intentions, it's just how do we maintain the child's ability to speak their mind and to have someone that they can speak with. We know that some children are actually thrown out of their homes if they identify themselves as being LGBTQ, as well as possibly transgender. I don't know of any individuals who have been thrown out for that, but that creates other problems that they have, and certainly that's a level of isolation, being homeless and trying to find a place to live and a way to support yourself as a youth. That's the dangerous situation, and what other issues might befall that person, including taking their own life or attempting to. Again, your speaker yesterday noted that the attempts to mutilate themselves because they don't see what they identify with. It seems a true Hobbesian dilemma that there's no good answer that's appeared to us yet. It may be, again, the case that we have to have a public figure, but I know that having more government intervention in what should be family issues or could be family issues doesn't seem to solve the problem either.
When you say good intentions, John Hunter, this legislation with good intentions, can you expand on what you mean by that? Because I think some people are struggling with the intentions of this bill and see it really as an intention to discriminate.
I understand and understand the question. I think the intention is a little bit back to what Mike was talking about, though, that you'd like to hope that most challenges can be resolved at the family level rather than in a government or at a school level, where the family can, and I think well-meaning parents, if they knew their child was struggling with something, would like to help. Now, that's, you can't generalize about parents at any more than you can generalize about students or generalize about counselors. So the idea is that if the family maybe knew something, that they could help in some way. But I understand, too, some people, and again, maybe saying what do they call it with the priest, the kind of the sanctity of the confessional,
sure.
You know, that it's not supposed to leave. If someone trusts their counselor but doesn't trust their parents, how does that work? So let me just tie that in, John, if I could.
Because 1057, one of the criticisms about it is that it's not trusting parents to have these conversations about what kind of care is appropriate for their child. 88 is sort of saying trust the parents to, you know, you got to tell the parents something's going on. So you might have somebody who is opposed to one and supportive of the other. Interesting partnerships, when you look at the things that we agree on, sometimes can be in contradiction with what somebody might expect if you're looking at it from that viewpoint, through that lens.
Agreed. The challenge is that you're trying to put a law together that, or both those laws, that apply to people as a whole, and we have so many individual circumstances that are different from all others. I mean, it's again, good parents, bad parents, good counselors, bad counselors. Those are stronger terms than I meant, but
right.
That you have all sorts of and communication issues and family relationships and new family relationships. There's all sorts of factors in there. It's hard to write laws about anything in this in that, given that broad range of circumstances.
Mm. All right, let's move on and talk about needs-based scholarships for state students.
Can I stop us just a second
go back? Yeah.
Perhaps what we do need is to identify, instead of saying this must be revealed, is to name someone who could be the trusted, you know, such as we have, for lack of, this may not be the right analogy, drop-off zones for children who would be abandoned at firehouses, hospitals, clinics, and places like that. We might be able to create a safe zone so that the child adolescent can speak with someone about these sorts of issues and achieve or receive help. You know, the difficulty then becomes, how do you pay for it outside a school setting? How do you make sure, again, that everybody's safe? But it seems that that's one way out, is to specify someone who can talk about these issues with the child.
Fascinating. And you know, I mentioned yesterday in our conversation that I'm acutely aware every time we have these conversations on the radio, who is listening and the damage that might be done by words. And I guess we have these conversations anyway, because I think it's so important to talk about it and to acknowledge that this can be confusing for people. I don't think it is a radical thing that people are curious, that they have questions, and some of those questions in this case are deeply personal. And that it's okay to talk about some of those things. That's, I guess, one of my philosophies for doing the show, whether that...
Well, yeah. And there are all sorts of different sets of ears. I kind of add into the counselors and the healthcare professionals, the pastors and others who have counseling skills and maybe different angle, but... The word you brought up is confusing, and that's the challenge. It could be confusing for the counselor, could be confusing for the student, could be confusing for the parent. They're all trying to do this, and that's why, you know, you talk about conversations, that if you can maybe talk about these things, it appears as though, at least a little bit, if those are kind of all bottled up inside, that it gets harder to resolve those things.
Yeah, I've had so many people off air come up to me and say, and almost whisper, like, you know, I want to be supportive, but I don't understand what it means. You know, that simply having the question, I want to be kind, but I don't know what I'm being kind about, because I'm confused. It's complicated. I do want to talk about needs-based scholarship for state students, because this is something that has not been successful in the past. But as we look at specifically brain drain, Mike Card, let's start with you, because this is Senate Bill 72, and it is... supported by the Board of Regents, saying that it's time for us to have a needs-based scholarship in South Dakota. Explain to people, Mike Card, what that means.
Well, I first have to give my disclaimer, because I'm an employee of the Board of Regents and the University of South Dakota, that the opinions I'm going to express are my own and not necessarily those of the Board or the University of South Dakota.
Duly noted.
Well done.
You know, higher education has and is becoming largely unaffordable. Technical education is almost unaffordable. And yet we know that, given the economic situation over the past 10 years since the Great Recession, as it's often called, indicates that those with some degree of post-secondary education are less likely to be laid off or more likely to have higher lifetime earnings than those who don't. And so we have a real push for individuals to pursue post-secondary education. Yet our wages in South Dakota don't always support what it costs to provide that higher education in South Dakota. So we find people perhaps leaving the state to pursue opportunities. Some join the military to pursue training and education and to get access to GI bills where they can afford to pay. Whether they come back or not is part of the issue. The need-based aid is there are lots of people in South Dakota who cannot afford post-secondary education. In a sense, it's financial inaccessibility that I believe the Board of Regents are trying to address.
John Hunter, any thoughts on this?
Well, first of all, I think Mike's very thoughtful about this. Those are challenges, and the affordability of college education is a big part of that. But the needs base, and just to clarify that just a little bit, the idea is that not necessarily all people who can't afford it, but students that could normally earn admission or earn, could have a broad chance of success at the university level, meeting certain admissions requirements and so forth. Right. But can't afford. That's the crack in the sidewalk that we're losing. Right. And you mentioned the brain drain.
ACT of at least 22 and a high school grade point average of 3.0 and above. So those are the kids we're talking about who qualify for a Pell Grant. So they're Pell Grant eligible from families that are not wealthy enough to send them.
Right. And so, and we recognize that even for all strata, their college education can be a challenge financially and private and public schools. So it's a sound idea. Everything about it, except then that somehow that money has to come in, and we have to either take that from other programs or from additional taxes or wherever that thing. So it's a balance that you have to strike. Is that more important than reducing tuition for all students? Which one is better? And so a great idea. You'd love to see it, and it'd be neat if we walked down the street and found some extra money that could be used for that. It would be a great return on investment.
Yeah. As a parent with a child in college, let me tell you, those out-of-state schools came
right,
in
checked.
A lot more affordable than the in-state schools. And there were places in-state that just could not compete with the ones from out-of-state who were recruiting. So it's a very real conversation that needs to be had. I want to close with the ban on plastic bags and the ban on the ban. This is legislation that is saying, no one in municipality or city should be allowed to ban plastics. And it brings up some really interesting arguments in Pierre, including one that says, hey, throwing plastic in the river might not be that big of a deal because fish use it for habitat. And John Hunter just reminded me when Representative Monroe said that of one of my relatives when we used to drive on the highway, and she would throw her empty cigarette packages out the window, and the kids in the car would be like, you can't do that. And she'd say, it's good. The birds will use it for nesting. And that was her excuse for littering. Interesting arguments come up when you talk about plastic. John Hunter, where do you want to start?
Well, I kind of figured you were heading for this one. That's the kind of thing that you like chatting about. So the quote of Mr. Monroe was that he's, I think, glad to see plastic coffee cans dropped in the river because they serve as habitat.
For bait fish, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So, yeah.
Maybe not the strongest argument of the day.
Well, I mean, I'm always surprised, for those people who know about Cleveland, when they tore down their old stadium, it was a big old concrete stadium, they dumped the whole thing in the lake to provide this new reef, and everyone thought that was a good idea. This still seems a little strange to me that you're throwing all this stuff in. I think there are some people who are going to agree with that. Plastic does not degrade or decompose kind of correctly. It's an oil, petroleum-based kind of thing. So it seemed to me that generally that plastic bags in natural habitat is not a good fit in that case. We'll get a few more bait fish, I suppose, but I still think it's not quite the right thing to do.
Some of the more pertinent arguments about this are about businesses and the impact that it has on businesses. And Mike Card, the reason I like, as John says, chatting about this is because there's real issues at stake here about pollution and about the impact on an economy. But people get so fired up. I was at the hotel in Rapid City and the people last night, and the people at the bar were asking for extra straws. To prove a point. People get excited and passionate about something, and we really just have maybe a minute left, Mike. So any thoughts on why this sort of brings out such strong responses from people about plastics?
Well, it changes your lifestyle. It changes your business supply chain. If you're a small restaurant and you have to try to find straws that many people can figure to be more expensive and find to be less useful than plastic straws.
And, all right, changing the lifestyle, yep.
Forces your life. The other part for some people, a fundamental issue of government. Should the state preempt their cities and counties from being able to enact laws that would do this?
All right, I'm sure we will talk more about this. John Hunter and Mike Card, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Lori.
Thanks, Lori. Thanks, John.
Republicans in the House Judiciary Committee are pushing forward a bill that criminalizes brokering commercial surrogacy. That's an arrangement where a surrogate mother is compensated beyond medical expenses for gestating an embryo. SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports.
The bill makes brokers who offer payments of money, advertise for, engage in, or profit from commercial surrogacy guilty of a Class 1 misdemeanor. It does not apply to the women carrying the child, healthcare providers, or those who pay for healthcare expenses of said woman or child. Emily Gehling is a co-founder of Dakota Surrogacy based out of Sioux Falls. Rather than banning commercial surrogacy, she suggests regulating the practice.
Of course, there is a risk that people take advantage of other people in every situation, and that is why we are vigilant to adhere to all of the guidelines and best practices.
The bill does not prevent or criminalize altruistic surrogacy. The prime sponsor of the bill wants to prohibit brokers altogether. Republican Representative John Hansen points to state law that charges a felony for buying a child through the state's adoption services.
In the surrogacy situation, you can try to pass all the regulations. Like in California, they passed a bunch of regulations. But there's still problems. There's still exploitation.
11 Republicans voted in favor of sending the bill to the House floor. The lone Democrat in House Judiciary voted against the bill over concerns of criminalizing struggling couples who are looking for alternatives. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strupinger in Pierre.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Looking for an individual segment from our radio program? You can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following the In the Moment Segments podcast. Have a story idea? Send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. The In the Moment podcasts are produced by Josh Heyer. For Lori Walsh, Steve Zwemke, and Josh, I'm Chris Lawfrey. Thank you for listening.